Shrink Wrap Radio number 551, Managing Anger Through Compassion, with Dr. Russell Coltz.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, when just enough to make it dangerous, it's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Russell Coltz, clinical psychologist, professor, and trainer in compassion-focused therapy. He's also the author of several books, including The Compassionate Mind Guide to Managing Your Anger, Using Compassion-Focused Therapy to Calm Your Rage and Heal Your Relationships. For more information about Dr. Russell Coltz, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Russell Coltz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. Compassion-focused therapist Paul Gilbert in the UK recommended you as a good follow-up to the interview that I did with him a few weeks ago because of, in part, I think, because of your specialization in working with anger. So how did you first become interested in working with anger?
Well, initially, much of my work as a psychologist was with people who suffered from PTSD or who've been traumatized. And particularly if you work in with veterans and groups like this, you end up, even if you're the primary presenting problem is PTSD, you end up doing quite a lot of anger work with that.
I can imagine. Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. And from the personal side, I think I mentioned to you, I'd done a TEDx talk. You're aware of that, I think. And if you'd seen that, you'd know that that's anger and irritability is an emotion that I'd struggled with personally for much of my life as well. So there was kind of a professional and a personal interest that led me there.
Yeah, right. In fact, in your TEDx presentation, I was intrigued by the story that you told about your child. It was about 3 months at the time, I think.
Oh, yes. I was home with him. I was fortunate in that my university arranged my courses in such a way that I could spend quite a bit of time at home caring for my son after he was born, which is wonderful. But I still had a lot of work to keep up with that I'd do during nap times and things like this. And there was this one day when I was holding him and he was just about going down for his nap. And I had been really looking forward to the nap on that particular day just because I had several emails that I needed to attend to.
Sure.
And things like that. And so he finally went to sleep and I set him down in the crib and I was tiptoeing to the other room to open up my computer just as quietly as I could. And just as soon as I pulled up my email, he woke up again. And
crying.
I was just crying. Yeah, he woke up crying and wanting to be picked up. Uh-huh. And I just was, there was this rush of anger. It just got really angry at him. And I think I mentioned in the TEDx talk, it took everything I could do not to just go in and you know, why can't you just sleep? You know, and it's not his fault that he's not sleeping exactly when I want him to sleep, right? He's just doing his thing. But that hit me, that when I noticed just a few seconds later that how angry I was, I thought, this is a problem. This is, you know, something that I've struggled with that I don't want to pass this along to him.
Yeah. Good thought. Boy. Yeah. I've had four kids myself, and your story reminds me, I wasn't really feeling anger, but one of my guys was coming down the hallway in his little onesie, you know, little flannel onesie, not very tall. And for some reason, I don't even remember why I said this, but I gave him a very forceful no, and he fell backwards as if he had been shot.
Yeah.
Just paralyzed and fell on his back. And of course, I felt horribly guilty. I don't think I was angry, but I was just trying to be firm.
Yeah. Well, and they... you know, there's some brain researchers, I think, that have looked at what happens when you say no or yes, when we hear that. And they're pretty distinct and pretty powerful responses to that.
Yeah. So, yeah. It was surprising to me. So anger, as you point out, is pretty challenging to work with. both in terms of, you talked about it in terms of working with yourself and also working with others. So talk to us a bit about the challenges of working with anger.
Well, anger really, first, as a bit of background, for those who don't much about compassion-focused therapy, we really look at motives and emotions and experiences people have through the lens of evolution. And so anger evolved with the purpose of helping us notice and respond to things that threaten us. And as such, it's a very powerful emotion. And so just in the way it organizes our attention and our thinking and reasoning and all the rest of our experiences when we're angry, it's very powerful.
Does it come from what's called our lizard brain? So it's very primal.
Absolutely. In CFT, we would call this old brain stuff. And if you look at anger responses in other sorts of species, you see consistency. And it's also, anger is one of the few what we might call basic emotions. The researchers that study these sorts of things, if you go, you could find anywhere a tribe of humans that had never had contact with the outside world. They'd never had any contact with anyone else. They wouldn't understand our language. They wouldn't understand almost anything about our communication, but they would know an angry face when they saw it.
Hmm.
Right? These experiences are almost archetypal. And, you know, a couple other complicating factors with regard to anger is that anger can feel really powerful, right? Anger is designed kind of to empower us to fight off threats. And so, you know, there's kind of a rush of sympathetic nervous system activation in the body. So we feel strong and we feel powerful. And particularly for people who may not feel very powerful in very many aspects of their lives, that experience of anger can be enjoyable in a sense. It can feel really good. Compassion-focused therapy also really developed, as I'm sure you talked with Paul about, to help people who struggle with shame and self-criticism. And I think there's some cultural shame around anger, at least in some groups of people, and not nearly as much sympathy. I mentioned in the TEDx talk, when we see people who struggle with sadness or who struggle with fear or anxiety, not always, but generally I think there tends to be a sympathetic response, right? We want to help those people. The sort of phenotypic response to anger, the way our face and our communication is shaped by it, really is designed to push other people away. Yeah. So even though when we're struggling with anger, we are struggling. We're struggling with the threat emotion in the same way that someone who's struggling with fear is struggling with the threat emotion. The response from others isn't generally to nurture. It's to withdraw and get away because we're... Or to get angry back. Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's very easy to get in situations where what we in CFT call the threat system between two people start, your threat systems bouncing off one another.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think it can be hard. I know for me, it was hard to actually sit there and admit I've got problems with anger. I've got problems with irritability. This is something that I actually need to work on. And that's really why I wrote my book and why I do CFT stuff applied to anger. I don't think the world needed me to give more anger management techniques. Actually, there are some wonderful people who have done great work on anger. Ray DiGiuseppe and Howard Casanova and Chip DeFrady and people like this have put out lots of books on anger. They have a lot of good information. I think the struggle is it's hard to get people who struggle with anger first to admit that they struggle with anger and then to really commit themselves to using those techniques and tools to work with it.
Yeah.
I think that's the primary struggle.
Yeah. Now, you broke anger down into different types of anger, and that's kind of news to me. I think of just anger. What are the types of anger?
Well, you know, I don't know how useful it is to get into lots of different subtypes, but anger serves different functions. So I think it's useful to see when does the anger show up? So if you're taking kind of a behavioral functional analysis approach to anger, understanding what happens before that tends to trigger the anger. For a lot of us, we have anger in response to feeling attacked. So there's this kind of defensive anger. But anger is also linked with drive pursuit. So if there's something we want or want to do, and there's a block to that experience of you know, something blocks our goal or gets in the way, very frequently you'll have a rush of anger in response to that.
That's what happened with your kid in the crib who was who blocked you from being able to read your email, right?
Absolutely. And if probably for all of us, and you know, anger, like just about anything else, particularly angry behavior, is shaped and to some extent kind of impacted by the context and the learning history of the person involved. So probably most of us can identify, okay, that's the situation that tends to trigger me, right? There are certain things that because of my own learning history and the context of my life, you know, we can tend to respond with anger in individualized sorts of ways.
Okay, and attention has emerged as a very important variable in lots of areas these days. And you talk about the role of attention in anger. Say a bit about that.
Absolutely. Well, as with pretty much all the threat emotions, and by threat emotions, I'm talking about things like anger, anxiety, fear, disgust, emotions that in CFT we see as really having evolved to help us identify threats and then organize a response to it. And one defining factor of those threat emotions is that they tend to very narrowly focus our attention onto whatever the perceived threat is. So that's very tricky because what it does is it keeps us from being cognitively flexible. It keeps us from being able to be reflective. It keeps us from being able to do things like perspective taking, to imagine things from maybe someone else's point of view. Probably most of us, particularly those of us who have ever struggled with anger, can identify with that situation where something happens and triggered, and you're just so focused on this. And then later when you reflect on it, you think, gosh, I don't even know why I was so upset. If I just would have thought about it for a moment, I would have realized, you know, this other thing. But, you know, like with my son, if I had just paused for a moment and thought, well, gosh, you know, is it his fault that he didn't fall asleep right away? Well, of course not. Right. But the way anger focuses our attention, it makes it very difficult to do that. I've been teaching a lot on this lately because in the States, as you know, we've had a very contentious political season, both leading up to the presidential election and really since then. And I think part of the problem is that people on both sides sort of interact with people on the other side in a way that's almost custom designed to trigger a threat response. Right. And it's interesting, even at the level of personal conversation, you can have two people sitting down with the very best of intentions. Both of us just want to be understood. But if we feel like we're not being heard, it's very easy to fall into a threat response of irritation or frustration or even anger. And then even though our underlying motivation is to be heard, we can communicate in such a way that it triggers the threat response on the part of the other person. And when that happens, nothing's getting through.
Yeah, I'm thinking of marital arguments as you talk that, which can just go faster than you can believe.
Absolutely. I do a bit of marital therapy. And whenever you look at almost any kind of conflict situation that's problematic, what you see are two threat systems just bouncing off of one another. And you've got two people who love each other and who want to care, who care about each other, who want to be together, but they're interacting in a way that systematically causes the other person to feel unsafe and sets them up to respond in a way that threatens you.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about the role of imagery and fantasy in anger.
Yes. This is something that's quite an emphasis in CFT. Earlier, when you mentioned the reptilian brain, one of the things we talk about in compassion-focused therapy is the interaction between sort of old brain and new brain structures and functions. And so what we see is that the areas of the brain, like the amygdala, that process threat emotions like anger. In CFT, we say those are very powerful, but they're not terribly clever or they're not very wise. And so your amygdala isn't always so good at distinguishing between information that's coming at you from the outside world through your eyes and your ears, distinguishing between that and imagery and fantasy. So if you have the thought that somebody doesn't like me or you imagine something bad happening to you, the same emotions can come up as might show up if that sort of thing actually did happen. Now, often to a lesser degree, but the idea is imagery is a very powerful input to the emotional brain and can trigger very powerful emotional and motivational responses. So this is why in CFT, I'm sure we'll get to this later,
yeah,
when we're when we're working on cultivating compassion, we're actually helping the person develop compassionate imagery that is soothing and that helps shift their emotions and their motivation in a helpful way. But it's interesting. I'll often have clients who say, I can't do imagery. I don't want to do this. I can't do it. And I'll say, well, what happens after you get really angry? Something triggers your anger. And they say, well, I just play it in my mind over and over like it's a movie and I can just see it happening again. Or I fantasize and imagine what I would do and what I'd say to them and stuff. Well, that's all using imagery. And it's all can serve as fuel. All that imagery feeds back to those parts of the brain like the amygdala that fuel the emotion. And so we can get into these tricky loops where the emotion fuels the imagery, which then feeds back on the emotion that created it.
Yeah, I always imagine brushing the teeth in around that topic where you've had some kind of difficult interaction and you're playing it in your mind, in my experience, standing in front of the mirror, brushing your teeth and thinking of, I should have said. Now, another big topic in psychology is motivation. And you talk about motivation and anger. What are you getting at there?
Well, anger really is associated with aggressive motivations. Anger is, in relationship to a threat or to a block to one's progress, anger is what we might call an approach emotion. Right? It motivates us to move towards whatever it is, but generally in an aggressive sort of way. So compassion really is based in motivational processes, in wanting to move forward in a helpful way. So that's a primary focus of CFT, helping the person identify what's the motivation that's there kind of embedded within the anger. And then just pause and reflect on, well, what do I really want to happen in that situation? Can I choose my motivation rather than rolling along with the default kind of angry motivation, which is one to harm, which is an aggressive motivation.
Now, you come from a background in cognitive behavior therapy. So, of course, you have a section in your book, you're kind of on each of those sort of main features of CBT. So one of the things you comment on is behavior in relation to anger.
Yes. Yes. Angry behavior tends to be, again, aggressive in nature, right? If it's anger-driven behavior, it can take various forms, but it tends to be an approach behavior and tends to take the form of some sort of aggression. Now, anger behavior, like all behavior, again, is mediated by our learning history and by current context. So it can play out in different ways. And this can be particularly tragic for people who struggle with anger. A lot of times people who struggle with anger, for example, they go to work, they've got a work situation that isn't great, or they hate their boss, and there's a lot of anger fuel, but they can't express that anger there, right? They might do a little passive aggressive stuff, but there are real consequences built into the workplace. If you go around raging or speaking nasty to your boss or something like that, then what do? They go home and they snap at their partner, or they snap at their children and do things like this. And why does that happen? Well, it happens because they can get away with it, right? So I think anger, like most threat emotions, narrows the spectrum of our attention, which tends to narrow behavioral flexibility as well.
Yeah. Right?
Behaviors tend to flow forward from that kind of angry motivation. And so that's one of the reasons why in CFT, a lot of the compassion work is focused on shifting perspectives from a perspective that's really driven by this evolved kind of threat system to one that's focused in a compassionate consideration of who do I want to be, right? What do I want to embody? How do I want to interact with these people? How do I want to be experienced by them?
Yeah. Now, in your TEDx presentation, you describe yourself as a person with an angry temperament. And I think the discussion of temperament is interesting. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm no temperament scholar, but to the way I talk about this typically is this idea that depending on who you are, you may tend to have certain emotional experiences more or less easily. right? Certain affects, certain emotions tend to arise more or less easily for you. So, for example, I'm by temperament not a very anxious person. There are a few things in my life that can trigger anxiety in me. Getting from point A to point B when I travel in unfamiliar places, for example, can make me a little anxious. But on a day-to-day basis, I don't struggle with anxiety too much. There's not that much that shows up for me. Whereas other people will tell you that anxiety is something they experience regularly throughout the course of about every day that shows up easily for them. So you might say that's someone has more of an anxious temperament. So for an angry or an irritable temperament, the idea is it's just that threshold for experiencing a little burst of anger is much lower. It takes less to kind of trigger that.
Yeah, even in babies and infants, those kinds of proclivities show up very early.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, as I talked about angry behavior, I talked about how all this is shaped by context and learning history and things like this. Well, some of the most powerful parts of our learning history are our attachment histories, how we were cared for by those who are close to us. And anyone who's ever taken care of infants knows that those fussy, kind of irritable babies are a lot harder to love than the sweet babies that just smile and coo all the time, yeah. Right? There are some babies that, you know, you hold them and they just snuggle in and it just feels great. And they're the other ones that are like, you know, they do a lot of that. And so from the caregiver's side, I think it can be a struggle to be quite as nurturing to those babies with the irritable temperament. So you can see how even from birth, and actually folks have been talking about this for decades in terms of epigenetic perspectives on development, where from the moment of birth, the child is helping to shape the environment that then shapes how they develop. There's this fluid interaction back and forth constantly, which can be very tricky depending on the temperament you kind of come into the world with.
Yeah. One of the points you make is that people can be very reluctant to give up their anger. And I think maybe you've already touched on that, but we'll just underscore
it. Yeah, well, I think so. I think it can feel strong. I think it can feel powerful. And, you know, the interesting thing about anger is we never really give it up. You can't get rid of it. It's an evolved kind of part of us. What we can do is cultivate the versions of us that we want to be more dominant parts of our personality. So if we can practice being compassionate, right? As brain scientists will tell you that, you know, every time we say something or think something or do certain things, we're strengthening patterns of cells in the brain. And this is a very important point because if we're thinking or doing something, it not only activates that pattern of cells like right now in the moment, in a way that corresponds to what we're thinking or feeling or doing, but it strengthens the connections within that pattern, which changes the probability in terms of how we will think or feel or behave in the future. So the question really is about what patterns do we want to strengthen? What aspects of ourselves do we want to sort of develop and kind of get the force of habit around? With anger, if you've got someone who has a hard time admitting that they have a problem with anger, and actually when they get a little angry, it feels powerful, and they don't feel really powerful around other aspects of their lives, it can be confusing in terms of not knowing what to do. But it can also, there can be some reluctance. It's like, if this is the way I feel powerful, I don't know that I want to give that up.
Mm-hmm. Right? So it can be a little bit addictive, it sounds like.
I think so. This is actually why I called the anger, the group. I've got a 12-week anger group that I ran in the prison for 3 years, and I haven't worked there for 3 or 4 years, but the folks I worked with there have continued to run the group. So it's been running for probably 5 or 7 years now. I called that group program True Strength, because one of the things that can really get people who struggle with anger on board for compassion work is when they realize that actually this anger that feels so strong in them often functions as a secondary emotion that they use to not feel more vulnerable feeling emotions like sadness or anxiety. In fact, I've had prisoners talk about pointed, if I'd write sadness or anxiety up on the board, they say, I don't feel that. I use anger to not go there. Mm-hmm. Because anger feels really powerful. And the time when they just really get committed to the compassion work is that they realize, wait a second, what's more powerful here? What's stronger? The anger that I use to avoid feeling vulnerable, or the compassion that lets me turn toward and confront those vulnerable feelings like sadness and anxiety and shame, and work with them directly. And that's why we call the group True Strength. And once you put it side by side like that, a lot of times a light bulb goes off in people's heads, and then they're pretty committed to it.
Yeah, that sounds like wonderful work. I'm glad you're telling us about that. In your TEDx presentation, you said it was reading a book by the Dalai Lama that inspired you to begin working on yourself through compassion. And I'm wondering, were you already a Buddhist at that point?
No, not at all.
Were you already a compassion-focused therapist?
Not really, no.
So that's interesting, yeah, that these two paths really opened up for you, and they're really not that different. What we're calling compassion-focused therapy is sort of a Western terminology, I think, for a Buddhist technology that's been around for a long time.
There's definitely a scientific context that CFT has that informs the way it works. The real difference between I think the Buddhist perspective on how you train compassion and what CFT does is that we have different what we call preliminary practices. Now, this is interesting because Buddhists have these too. In fact, that's a Buddhist term. In Buddhism, a lot of times, at least in the Nyingma tradition, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition I was initially trained in, what would happen is that before you would be taught certain kind of advanced practices, there were certain what they call preliminary practices that you had to do, which were really designed to prepare the mind so that when you got to the advanced practices, it would work, right? And you would benefit from them. And in CFT, that's true as well, although our preliminary practices are in some ways a little different and involve helping people understand their emotions and motives from kind of in the context of evolution and in the context of how our brains work, mm-hmm. and things like this. Because a lot of times when people struggle with dealing with emotions like anger or fear or whatever they're struggling with, what goes along with that is a lot of shame and self-criticism. In fact, that's really why Paul developed CFT, as he observed that he had these CBT patients who, when you did the kind of CBT depression protocols with them that, research showed worked with people, it didn't work with these folks. They could say, well, I can see how I was making all these thinking errors, and I've gathered some evidence, and I've created some more database thoughts that actually are much more accurate, but I don't feel any different. I don't feel any differently. And what Paul observed is that these people had a lot of shame and self-criticism, and so would relate to themselves in pretty harsh, shaming ways, even when they were doing the thought work. And so what happens is, what I've found, and I think we've got some studies that speak to this, is that if you take the Buddhist compassion meditations, which often involve visualizations and repeating phrases and things like this, and you take someone who has deeply entrenched shame and self-criticism and just say, okay, do these meditations, it's going to bounce off them like Teflon. It just doesn't feel real to them. They just can't relate to themselves in that way because they've got lots of evidence that says, look at how bad I am, right? Look at how I behave. Look at what I did. Look at what I think. Look at how I feel. And they can use all of this as a way to like, as barriers to self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And so what CFT does that a lot of the other kind of compassion models don't do so much is we weave in a lot of stuff about helping people understand where their emotions and their behaviors and their motivations come from in terms of the evolution of the species, the way our brains work, their social shaping history, so that they can move from this thing that I struggle with is something that's bad about me, this is evidence that I'm bad, to understanding how this stuff, what I'm doing and saying and feeling and thinking, how that makes sense, both within an evolutionary context in terms of how my brain was shaped by evolution, in terms of a neurological context, in terms of how the brain works, and in terms of the an attachment sort of social shaping context. And so one question that I ask the folks when I'm doing workshops is I'll say, okay, I want you to bring to mind that thing that you struggle with, right? Remember the thing you tend to criticize yourself for, you know, the time you struggle, you have a hard time in whatever situation that is. And then I'll pause and say, I'd like you to think about your history, right? Your background, how you were raised, the family in which you grew up, the different things that happened to you. Given all of that, does it make sense that you would have this particular struggle? Does it make sense, given that context, that you would have a hard time with whatever this is?
And do they get an image from the past typically?
Oftentimes they will, right? Mm-hmm. You can get engaged. In CFT, it's very much a process of guided discovery. So there's a lot of Socratic dialogue, a lot of just asking people, you know, how does this make sense? How does it make sense that you would struggle with this given your history? And the secret is there's always, from their side, there's always a valid reason that people are doing and thinking and feeling what they're doing. Marsha Linehan in dialectical behavior therapy, very early on, would encourage clinicians to look for the kernel of wisdom in the client's behavior. From their side, developmentally, somehow it makes sense. There's something served by that behavior. And once people can recognize that, oh, actually it makes sense I would struggle with this, that softens the ground for compassion. Mm-hmm. Right?
And that image, softens the ground.
It really is. I think as a metaphor, it's good too, right? If you've got cold, hard ground that's been tromped on millions of times.
I live on adobe, so it makes particular sense.
Oh, good, good. You know that, right? You can't drop the seeds of compassion on top of that and expect anything to happen.
Right.
We got to prepare the soil.
Yeah. Now, both you and Paul say that compassion begins with courage. What's your version of that?
Well, I think compassion has a number of components. I think courage is a big one. A kind motivation to help is I think, the other kind of big part of that. But the courage, when we're asking people to cultivate compassion, or we're kindly suggesting that they consider cultivating compassion, the thing we have to be clear about is compassion only exists in the presence of suffering. Compassion begins with turning toward suffering or struggle. And in the case of self-compassion, that suffering and struggle quite often is the stuff that you hate most about yourself, the stuff that you really don't want to admit about yourself, the stuff you may criticize, or maybe you don't even criticize it because it's so painful you don't even allow yourself to acknowledge it. And so you come back around to the barriers to people who struggle with anger. I mean, I have to say, as a father, you know, when I had that awareness that I was modeling stuff for my son that I didn't want him to develop, it would have been really easy for me to say, I'm a bad father. Look at me, I'm being a bad father. And that's an acutely painful place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Had I done that, you know, it might have been easy just to push it out of my mind, just distract myself and focus on other stuff. But, you know, but harder to turn towards it and say, look, I'm struggling with anger and irritability. I don't want to pass this along to my son, and that means I've got to do something about it, even though it's really painful to admit this to myself, something I struggle with. And so I think that's the courage of compassion, is the willingness to turn toward the stuff that makes us really uncomfortable, because it's only then that we can kind of look deeply into it, understand the causes and conditions that contribute to it and maintain it, and then do something about it.
Yeah. In your book on compassion-focused therapy for dealing with anger, I was interested in your discussion of soothing and safeness.
Yeah. So you've heard me talk, I've mentioned, I think, the threat system so far. In compassion-focused therapy, we really group emotions and motives based on evolutionary function. And so we have this model called the three circles. And one of those circles is the threat system, or the threat circle, which is focused on identifying and responding to things that threaten us. The second circle, the blue circle, is the drive and resource acquisition circle, which is really things like excitement and motivation and lust. These are emotions that motivate us to move toward our goals and to keep working, pursue them, and then reward us for attaining them. So when you get a raise or get a new job or get an A in a class, you get that kind of dopaminergic rush of pleasure. It feels really good. That's your drive system.
Yeah.
Now, both the threat system and the drive system have that effect of narrowing our attention and our thinking and reasoning on the focus. For the threat system, the focus is threat, which was good for our ancestors, right? If you're walking along and a tiger jumps out, there's a real physical threat there. You want your attention to be very much captured and your focus to be on that. But it gets in the way in modern society when the threats that come at us are, you know, our boss said something that made us feel unappreciated or whatever.
Yeah.
The drive system also, drive system emotions tend to focus us this time on the goal or whatever we're pursuing. So the third system we talk about is the soothing or safeness. And the soothing or safeness system is important. And we tend to talk about that a little more because when people come into CFT and they have problems, very often what they have problems with are threat stuff. And sometimes with drive stuff as well. We live in a culture, by the way, that tends to fuel threat and drive responses. Because as in terms of if you're an advertiser or a politician, hitting people in the threat and drive systems tend to motivate behavior. Right? It's a good way to get people to buy your stuff or to vote for your candidate. I like to say in the workshops that in terms of the safeness system, right, if a commercial came on television and said, you know, you already have everything you need. Right. You wouldn't sell very much. So advertisers don't do that. So we think it's important that people recognize that there are different kinds of positive emotions. And yes, there are those exciting, euphoric ones. But there's also feeling safe and content and peaceful. And that's the kind of the domain of the safeness system. And I want to highlight just a couple parts of that right now, because they're important for people to think about.
Good.
First, we really evolved to feel safe through affiliation, through connection with people who accept us and care about us and can nurture us or relate affectionately to us. That's how we're really designed to feel safe. Now, this can be very tricky if people have histories of trauma or difficult attachment where the people who were supposed to help and help them feel safe and help them when they were distressed, if those people didn't help them, they weren't able to, right? They were instead threatening. Then people can learn to have a lot of problems feeling safe in connection with others. And that's actually a lot of what we do in therapy. But if you can get the safeness soothing system online, if you can get people to feel safe and calm and content, what happens is that focus that we see of the attention and thinking and reasoning, et cetera, in the threat system opens wide. There's a whole host of studies in different areas of science that show that when people feel safe and feel connected, lots of good things happen. We think more flexibly, we're more creative, and even we're more altruistic. We tend to be more pro-social in how we relate to one another. So that's a big part, and to how do we relate to ourselves? So a big part, I think, of working compassionately with struggle or with suffering is helping ourselves to feel a little safer, because when that happens, we're really preparing the mind to be compassionate and to be skillfully compassionate, to be creative, to be able to do things like perspective taking, imagining how something feels from another person's shoes. We don't do that when we're in threat.
Yeah.
We can do it when we feel safe.
Yeah, we have this term now, self-soothing.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's almost a new idea to me, maybe by a few years. We never used to talk about self-soothing. And so what are some of the safe, good ways that we can self-soothe?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. If we have a pretty decent attachment history, for most of us, the things that are going to help us soothe are going to be social connections with people that care about us. So that's going to be one really powerful method of soothing. But I have to say, in terms of the specific things that are very soothing to us and help us feel safe, that can vary from person to person. And so when I'm working with clients or when I'm doing workshops, we'll do an exploration to get people to think about what are the times or the situations when I feel really safe and calm and content, and get people to really think about that. And there are various things, particularly for people who struggle to feel safe in connection with other people, to help them figure out what are the things that do make me feel safe. Recently, you're probably aware that they do these world happiness studies. And for several years, the Scandinavian countries have been, they regularly score to the top. Denmark has been highlighted as being at the top for at least a few years. And in the Danish culture, I actually did a workshop in Denmark. And so I spent some time when I was in Denmark talking with people over there about their culture. And actually, I've been thinking about this for 5 or 6 years. I should have written a book, because in the last year and a half, like 10 books have dropped on this subject. And I'm very happy getting attention. If you talk to a Danish person about their culture, it would almost be impossible for you to talk to them, for them to say more than 3 or 4 sentences without saying the word hygge. Now, hygge is spelled H-Y-G-G-E. There's not really a translation in English for the word hygge, although, and I think it's kind of culturally meaningful that that's the case. Usually when it is translated, hygge is translated as coziness, but that doesn't really capture it. Probably the best definition of hygge I've heard is that feeling you get when you're with people you care about, in a really comfortable situation, talking about pleasant things, maybe having some nice food and something warm to drink with really nice lighting. I mean, I say the lighting not to be humorous. Actually, if you look at the kind of Danish culture and how it's kind of gotten out into the larger world culture over the last century, what you're going to see is design. So lamps, lighting, furniture, things like this. They put a lot of thought into how do we create a cozy atmosphere for ourselves. Part of this is probably because in Denmark, the winter lasts many, many months, and it's cold and miserable. And unlike other Scandinavian countries, they don't have good ski mountains. So they spend a lot of time inside. The Danish have the highest per capita use of candles. They work very hard to create what they would call hygge spaces, like infused with this quality of hygge. And so we can feel comfortable and connected together and warm and safe. And
my wife has begun to use that term. I think she read about it in a New York Times article. And so she started to put some energy in that direction and to underscore when we're doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the trick to it, with all the soothing stuff in CFT and with hygge, I would say, is we want to use soothing not as an avoidance strategy, right? If all we do is soothe, 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 hygge, 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 right? Every time something happens that makes us uncomfortable, we go do that instead. Well, that's avoidance. And if you look at many of the major forms of psychological or psychiatric diagnosis, those are underpinned by processes of avoidance. So we don't want soothing. It's not, I guess in CFT, you're not soothing anything away. You're not trying to get rid of the anger or the fear or whatever it is. The idea is to help yourself move from the threat system to feeling a little more safe so that you can open up and be able to do things like perspective thinking and thinking creatively and effective problem solving. So you work to regulate, to balance your emotions, and then to come back to work with whatever the tricky situation is or whatever the difficult emotion you're struggling with is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. And you just said hygge, hygge, hygge. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. But it seems like here these days we have mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness.
Very popular.
Yeah. How does mindfulness? I've speculated that we might be in a mindfulness bubble. I'm not sure.
It's like you get a Happy Meal with a side of mindfulness, right?
Yeah. So where does mindfulness fit into the development of compassion? Because I know it's a big piece.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason. You know, we joke about mindfulness being everywhere. There's a reason mindfulness is everywhere. And that is, I think, if it's applied skillfully, it's tremendously helpful in probably most aspects of life, truthfully. Mindfulness is really about present moment awareness, just being aware right now what's happening, right? And that's what's happening outside of me and around me, but it's also what's happening within me. How does my body feel? What emotions are coming up in me? What thoughts are coming up in me? And so when we have that awareness, it can be tremendously powerful. So for example, in applying compassion-focused therapy generally, and it specifically with regard to anger, we do direct mindfulness training with my clients. And the reason is, so for example, people who struggle with anger, if, you know, a lot of the problems that they have are due to the fact that the anger feels like it's just there, right? They're trekking along and something triggers the anger. And by the time they notice it, it's full throttle. And when your threat system is fully kicked in, it can feel almost impossible to do much about it. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but for me, there have been a couple times in my life where I was so angry. It was almost like I was on this train and I didn't want to be on it, but I didn't know how to get off of it. And I think that people can feel trapped in these emotions. Well, one way of working with anger, if you can increase your awareness of the cues that trigger the anger and what it feels like when anger starts, so you can go, oh, look, I'm starting to get angry. What do I want to do? Right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times the really full-blown aggressive anger that people struggle with, it's not just something although it can feel like this, it's not just something that's triggered immediately by something that happens in the environment. Something happens and then you get in these loops where the attention is focused on it. And as we've talked about, they start creating imagery around it, start thinking about it, and it just fuels itself. And then boom, you get the anger outburst or whatever the behavior is.
Mindfulness can create a little window of space where you can notice what the trip you're about to automatically flip into.
Absolutely. You can notice, oh, look, I'm playing that again in my head over and over. Oh, yeah. Look what I'm thinking about. And one of the things that a lot of the commonly practiced mindfulness exercises do is they train you to notice the thought and then come back to an attentional focus like the breath or, you know, something else. Mm-hmm. And that trains us, again, not only to notice thinking and mental imagery and all that stuff as mental experiences rather than the stuff of reality, but it also does, it gives us something to do instead, right? And one of the things I really like mindful breathing practices, because anyone who's done mindful breathing for very long will notice that sometimes you don't feel like sitting there and watching your breath. Right. Anyone who has an ongoing mindfulness practice is going to get really good at dealing with the thought, I don't want to do this right now. Right. So you notice, oh, look, I just had the thought I don't want to do with that. Back to the breath. Right. And so this is very important because we're dealing with emotions like anger or dealing with other things like this. The ability to sit with an emotional state that is right now quite uncomfortable. Right. I keep talking about Marsha Linehan today. She's done so much tremendous work with borderline PD, what she would call distress tolerance. Distress tolerance is a huge part of compassion, being able, because, you know, compassion is coming into contact with stuff that makes you uncomfortable. Well, if you're going to work with that stuff, you've got to be able to be there and kind of tolerate it while that happens. So I think there are many aspects of mindfulness training that are helpful in working with difficult emotions. Being able to move the attention where you want to, being able to notice thoughts and let go, and being able to kind of tolerate uncomfortable states of emotion while you just sit and breathe or focus your attention on something that's not kind of mood related.
You know, we've been talking about anger and we're talking about compassion, and compassion to me suggests a focus on other people, of cultivating caring for other people. Yeah. Why that?
Why compassion?
Yeah.
You know, this is a good question. I did a workshop for an ACT crowd, an acceptance commitment therapy crowd, and they really focus on values. And so I think one of the responses, well, you know, there are lots of values you could have. Why compassion? Why are you guys so hung up on compassion? Now, I would say in CFT, while CFT can be a value, or rather, while compassion can be a value that you can choose to pursue, that in CFT, it's more seen as an orientation to suffering. So the answer to the question, why compassion, is that if you look at the kind of problems people have, you know, almost all of them are going to involve some sort of suffering or struggle that's experienced by you, or perhaps in the case of anger, that's experienced by the people around you, right? You're behaving in a way that creates suffering or discomfort for them. And so again, compassion gives us a way to turn toward that stuff, not with shame or condemnation, but with this willingness to ask questions like, what would be helpful? What would be helpful in the face of this? Okay, I'm feeling really angry. I don't want to act this out in a way that's going to be hurtful to my wife, my child, or whoever. What would be helpful for me to do now? In fact, I think when I'm doing a real quick like public talk on compassion, if I'm doing something like that, I'll often say, you know, if you want to bring compassion into your life with kind of efficiently, I'd suggest two phrases. The next time you see yourself struggling, ask yourself first, given what I know about me and the brain and everything that's happened in my life, does it make sense that I would struggle with this? Or does it make sense that my child would struggle with this? Does it make sense that my partner, my coworker would struggle with this? And the answer to that question is almost always going to be yes. And the second question is, given this, given what's happening right now, what would be helpful? And in some ways, that answers part of your question about why mindfulness is so important and compassion. Because if you think that, given this, what would be helpful? The given this part of that is really mindful awareness. Given this, that this is happening right now.
Yeah.
Not judging it, not labeling it, not saying it's good, bad, right, wrong, I want it, I don't want it. Just given this, that this is the way things are right now, what would be helpful? So,
and what does that lead to in your experience of the people that you work with?
Well, I think it leads to courageous moves then to try and do something that would be helpful. You know, a lot of the messages behind CFT are really to help people replace kind of judgment and condemnation with kind understanding and kind curiosity. And what I find is that when people stop attacking and beating themselves up or the stuff they do that makes them uncomfortable, then they can actually work on doing better. You know, because yeah, they're not avoiding, they're working with it. They're saying, oh, wow, look at me. I'm really angry right now. What do I want to do with this?
It sounds like it would also open up a space for some creativity potentially. Like, how can I deal with this situation in a creative way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there again, we get back to why compassion, part of the why of compassion is it helps shape our emotional experience in such a way that moves us from the threat that really constrains us to keep us focused on whatever the problem is and the consequences, perceived consequences of it. When we can relate compassionately towards ourselves and say, oh gosh, it makes sense that I would respond this way or that they would respond this way, what would be helpful? That helps us feel a little safer. It helps us feel a little more comfortable, which opens us up so we can be creative. So we can consider things from the other perspectives. And that other perspective could be a perspective of another person, or it could be, you know, what would the future version of me 5 years from now, will I even remember this interaction? Will I care about this? What will I, you know, and so to kind of do some perspective taking in that way too, you know, is this that big of a deal that I need to get hung up on this? Or is this about my learning history and my triggers?
Hmm.
Would it be better just to find other ways to work with it?
Which comes first, compassion for others or self-compassion?
Well, it depends. And I think it depends on the person. Sometimes you will hear people say things like, if you don't love yourself, you can't love anybody else. Or exactly. If you don't have compassion for yourself, you can't have compassion for other people. I actually don't think I agree with that. And the reason I don't agree with it is that I'm a psychologist and I know tons of mental health professionals who have incredible amounts of compassion for other people and really struggle directing it toward themselves. Mm-hmm. So my experience actually doesn't speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Actually, in CFT, we talk about three flows of compassion. There's the compassion that flows out from me to you. There's the compassion that flows from you to me, being able to receive and accept that. And there's the compassion that flows from me to me. So I talk a lot less about what has to come first and a lot more with asking people to reflect on their own experience and think, what are the flows that actually work pretty well for me? And which are the ones that I struggle most with? And then to use the one that they're relatively kind of feel stronger at as a building and a platform for connecting with compassion and then expanding to the other flows. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
So I guess I don't have a great answer as to which one comes first, because I actually think that varies from person to person, depending on their learning history. And actually, there are cultural differences, too. There's a very famous kind of story from, I think it was the first Mind Life meeting, where basically a Western teacher asked the Dalai Lama, what do you do with these students that just are self-loathing and hate themselves and what we now would say have no self-compassion? And His Holiness initially looked confused. He was like, well, I, in my experience, that's not so much of a problem. Of course, all the Western teachers' faces dropped, and they're like, and His Holiness is a pretty quick guy. He's like, what? Am I wrong about this? And they're like, yeah, our students are all like that. And by the way, we are too. But it sounds like in the culture His Holiness was embedded within, the Indian culture and the Tibetan culture, that self-loathing and self-hatred weren't really problems, right? Yeah. But that in the West, clearly, for many of us, they are.
Yeah, what triggered that question for me was, and I don't remember if it was with Paul Gilbert or somewhere else, that there was a pretty clear statement of, we see self-compassion as a more advanced thing that we don't get into right away, but focus on developing compassion for others. So that's kind of where the question was coming from.
I think that oftentimes that is how you start. And I think that's how you start, because I think a lot of people do have an easier time feeling compassion for other vulnerable people than they do for themselves. Mm. So when you're trying to initially awaken those experiences of compassion in someone to get them, like, so for example, in the prison, there were a lot of guys that I would work with in the prison who'd say, I don't know anything about compassion. I've never felt compassion. I got nothing to say about this compassion stuff. So I say, okay, well, let me ask you to imagine something. Imagine you're walking along the street and you've just had lunch with a friend and you're very happy because you had pizza for lunch and it was really good. And you're even happier because you've got half of your pizza left. And so you're looking forward to the lunch you're going to have tomorrow too. So you're excited that you've got another good pizza lunch coming up tomorrow. And you're walking down the street and you see a little girl, maybe a 7 or 8 year old girl, sitting there back against the building, and she's just sitting there crying. You know, what do you do? And by the way, you stop and you ask her, you say, oh, you know, are you okay? What, you know, why are you crying? And the little girl lets you know that she's homeless and her mother's homeless and her mother's out actually trying to get a job. And she's crying because she's hungry, because she hasn't eaten yet today. So what do you do? And of course, all the guys in the group, you know, they basically said, well, there's any number of things I would do. But the first thing I do is I give her the pizza, right? I hand her the pizza, you know, and these are guys in prison. Not one of them said, I'd think about, gosh, what is more important. They just almost automatically, they all said, we just give her the pizza. I said, well, did you have to pause and think about that? And they looked at me like I was crazy. Like, no, of course you give her the pizza. What are you, dense? Well, that's compassion.
What did you learn working with those guys in prison? Maybe you went into it with some preconceptions. Any of those preconceptions get changed?
Well, I went in not so much with preconceptions, but with just kind of not knowing. And maybe it's the kind of mindfulness training I've had. I kind of go in not knowing what's going on. I was a little scared the first time I did work at the prison. And I will say the first bit of prison work wasn't as a psychologist. It was as a volunteer in the Buddhist group. Mm-hmm. So I would go and I'd lead meditation sessions and things like this. And so that wasn't so bad, because it wasn't quite as scary, because I knew I was going in to meet with people who were in prison, but these were Buddhists who were in prison. So, you know, how bad could it be, right? And it was a wonderful experience. It was really wonderful. So by the time I actually started doing CFP stuff in the prison, I was already comfortable with the prison, and I already knew some people in there, and so I was kind of desensitized. So I went in just wondering how it would go. And what I found was that these guys in the prison were the single most committed, hardworking group of clients I'd ever had in my life. They, and when we talked about, I mean, they took the groups, they took the compassion group, and they worked it. And I gave them a 130-page manual, which is way too dense, and they read it, and they read it. In fact, I even have an outcome study that I'm going to be working to publish over the next few months, and I actually haven't gotten to publish yet. And one of the reasons was that the outcomes in the people in the CFT group were very good, but the effects, the time by group interactions, the differences in terms of outcome between the CFT group and the control group, the people who didn't get the group, weren't significant a lot of the time, because our control group people were getting better too. And I couldn't figure it out. I'm like, is anything going on with the prison? Why is our control group going up in compassion and going down in anger? Why is this happening? And I actually, we had this monthly follow-up group with the guys in the anger group. And I asked them, I said, do you have any ideas? There's something going on in the prison or something like this? And they kind of looked down and they kind of looked at me and they're like, we may know what's going on. I said, well, what? And they're like, well, a lot of those guys, they're like our cellmates or our they're in our, and so we've been teaching them this stuff. They've been showing them the manual.
They've been doing missionary work.
Yeah, they have been, which of course as a researcher is very problematic. Yeah. But in terms of asking questions like, how do you change the culture of a prison? Right. It was very powerful that these guys were not only benefiting, but the work they were doing with compassion made them want to help one another. They made them want them to help. They wanted to help other guys that weren't in the group. And I've had guys write me from prison and people who have gotten out saying, hey, I want to do this work. I want to help, you know, help people who get out of prison. I want to help get it into other places. So it has been a really fantastic experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did want to highlight something that I think speaks to your question really poignantly. When we asked the guys what was really beneficial about the group, they had a lot of things to say. But one of the first things that I always said was that one of the most powerful things initially for them was the compassion that we directed toward them. I think you asked about preconceptions and things like this. I think we live in a culture where a lot of people see people in prison as being qualitatively different from me, like those are the bad people. And even a lot of the guys in the prison would say that. They'd say things like, oh, didn't you know we're the scum of the earth, right? And, you know, when you think of yourself like that or when others treat you like that, it's very hard to be motivated to do better. It's very hard to be anything else, right? When your whole system reinforces that you're one of the bad ones. And for them, it was really powerful that we went in and, you know, over the course of the group, I learned about a number of their offenses. But during the initial introduction, I said, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself and why you're here, but please don't share your offenses with me, because I don't want the first way I learned to relate to you to be based on this one, you know, the worst thing you've ever done. You're not the worst thing you've ever done. Yeah. That doesn't define you. And for them, they said, starting out, compassion became real to us because we saw it coming to us from you, you know. And sometimes, you know, when you don't believe in yourself, when someone else believes in you, after a while, it gets through.
You know, that's a perfect place, I think, for us to wrap the interview up. It's a nice, strong close. So, Dr. Russell Coltz, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
I'm glad I followed up on Dr. Paul Gilbert's suggestion to interview Dr. Russell Coltz. I think the prison work he's doing is especially commendable. So much of our approach to those in prison is punitive rather than rehabilitative, and those of us outside the prison system tend to want to know as little as possible about life inside. In fact, we have many stereotypes about prisons and prisoners that are grounded in movies rather than reality. I, myself, in the past, have had offers to teach a psychology class at San Quentin, but I have to confess I was fearful of going through those walls. My university dean and others who've done so said it was a very enriching experience, not only for the convicts, but for themselves. I'm also struck by the degree to which Buddhist-inspired ideas and practices are entering mainstream therapy. There was a time, in my time even, that would have been looked upon askance. Now it seems to be widely accepted, though often repackaged in terminology that has a scientific ring and or actual scientific research. I want to call your attention to Dr. Russell Colt's website. You'll find it at compassionatemind.net, where you can discover links to free exercises related to anger management. You'll find quite a compendium of exercises, manuals, and audio files in the left-hand margin on the Working with Anger tab there. It's a very open-handed, generous offer of resources that will be of value to therapists and clients alike. Similarly, I think therapists and clients alike will benefit from purchasing a copy of Dr. Colt's book, The Compassionate Mind Guide to Managing Your Anger, Using Compassion-Focused Therapy to Calm Your Rage and Heal Your Relationships. As always, you're encouraged to use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site to do that.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Selena Mitchell. I'm a licensed acupuncturist in Fresno, California, and a student of psychology and an avid listener of your program. I wanted to let you know that your programs have regularly inspired me and have ever since I began listening to them a year ago. Thank you for all the thought and hard work that you've put into your excellent podcasts, and I look forward to listening more in the future. Recently, I realized how often I access your podcasts and look at your website and have decided to make a donation in the hopes that you can keep doing what you do for many more years to come. I plan to make more donations in the future as I become available to the funds. I encourage other listeners to do the same. Dr. Dave's programs are an excellent resource and are exposing us to nuances within the field of psychology that would otherwise be hard to come by, and it's so readily and easily accessible in this format. So thanks again, Dr. Dave, and I look forward to listening in the years to come. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, licensed acupuncturist Selena Mitchell. I think I'm already in some of those years to come. Your ongoing financial contributions and those of others really help to keep me going. You know, there are a number of advertising opportunities that have come my way, but I pass up most of them. The thing I feel really good about promoting, the thing I believe in, is the work I'm doing here on your behalf, Shrink Wrap Radio. So if you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Selena Mitchell and others who are willing to chip in each month? We have one new donor, and she is Lindsay Mingus. Thank you, Lindsay. Is there a chance you'd be willing to help me test out some online discussion software for the market research consulting I do part-time? This software would help facilitate a multi-day discussion. I've created a discussion topic about podcasting, and I need some people who are willing to go online and answer 5 or 6 questions about the podcast that they listen to. And I don't ask you for any feedback on Shrink Wrap Radio, but I do ask that you return to that discussion for a few days following to comment on other people's responses. The time commitment each day is probably no more than 5 or 10 minutes. I'll then have this discussion as a sample to show potential clients. If you'd be willing to help me out with this, please drop me a line at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember, wrap is spelled just R-A-P. And I'll send you the link to participate. I will be so grateful for your help. It's been a while since I've mentioned our Shrink Wrap Radio app. It allows you to stream or download Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on your smartphone, whether it be an iPhone or Android phone. It also gives you access to almost 400 of the most recent episodes. Amazing, all of that content in your pocket or purse. Go to the apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full details. Finally, let me wrap up this segment of the show by reminding you to go to our website and look at the list of books by some of our past guests. They're in the right-hand sidebar on our website, and you can click on the book covers there to order directly from Amazon.com. Let's reward these guests for choosing to advertise on our website. The most recent edition is Trauma and Transformation, a 12-step guide by licensed clinical social worker Rivka Ettery.
Hi, this is Andy Matzner, psychotherapist, author, and tarot reader, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
With that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can always leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Russell Coltz, for his insights on managing anger with compassion. As I mentioned a moment ago, next week's return guest will be licensed clinical social worker Andy Matzner, and we'll be discussing journaling as a tool for recovering from addictions and compulsive behavior. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.